Welcome back to another session of Tanya 200. We're covering the first part of Tanya, and we're up to chapter 19. What we spoke about until now, and what the Tanya says in chapter 18, is that there is a love, a part of the heart with which we serve God, that is absolutely true. It's a love and an emotion that we cannot produce. And therefore it's available even to people who don't have the wisdom or the knowledge or the understanding of godliness that would produce an emotion in the heart. And so it's more available than any of the other kinds of love, and yet it is the truest form of love. Where does this come from? The Rebbe says it comes from inheritance. We inherit it from the patriarchs, so that it's an inborn connection to God that we don't produce. It's there in our soul. What kind of a love is that? How do we inherit it? And how does this love include also fear? The Rebbe began explaining that we inherit from our patriarchs, we inherit a godliness. Not an emotion, not a love for God that is a mere emotion. We inherit from them a godliness. What does this mean? It means that the patriarchs didn't choose to be godly. Their godliness was not an option. It was not a religion. It was not something they found or discovered. They were the embodiment of something godly. And therefore, they transmit to their offspring their own essence, and the offspring also are godly. A human being can give birth only to another human being. What you are essentially is what you pass on to your children. The patriarchs were not good people. They were godly, and therefore all the souls of their descendants contain at least a minimal level of godliness. What is godly? Godly is that which the chokhmah of our soul perceives. The faculty of chokhmah, which is the first of the 10 faculties that the soul has, is called a mental faculty, one of the 3 mental faculties of chokhmah, bina, and das, which make up the acronym for Chabad. But real understanding and comprehension takes place in the second function of the mind, not in the first function. The first function of the mind, chokhmah, which is broken into 2 words, koyach ma, the potential for what is an openness of mind rather than a grasping of the mind. It's the openness that the mind has for what is unknown, for what is above it, for what's out there. And because the chokhmah doesn't care to grasp the idea, it only wants to discover it, it is therefore capable of apprehending or perceiving God. Because God is not knowable. Human intelligence can't encompass him. No thought can comprehend him. Therefore, Bina will not be able to handle God. Bina will be frustrated by its inability to comprehend and to grasp, to master the subject of God. And so God is not available to Bina, but God is available in Chochmah. That's where God connects, that's the point of contact between God and the human being, between God and the human soul. So the soul sees God, because Chochmah sees rather than understands. Chochmah sees God, and that's where our faith comes from. In other words, the perception of Chochmah is called faith. The perception of Bina is called comprehension. That's why people can have faith even if they don't have understanding. People who don't study, who don't immerse themselves in the subject of godliness or holiness, can and do believe in God very intensely, very real belief, very valid belief. It can be valid without the knowledge and without the understanding, because Chachma doesn't need to understand. Chachma is interested in what is not known. And that basically is why, or how, human beings have made any great discoveries. If our functions didn't begin with Chachma, if all of our activities began with Bina, with the need to understand, we would not have progressed very far. We would have taken possibly tiny steps. Based on what we knew yesterday, we would proceed and gain a little more understanding today, and then a little more understanding tomorrow. But there wouldn't be these magnificent new discoveries, these dramatic breakthrough ideas, which came to people basically on faith. It was such a revolutionary new idea, there's no way they could have proven it, there's no way they could have really understood it. It was a leap of faith. And by this leap of faith, they made great discoveries, and because of this chachma of our soul, we don't live in caves anymore. We were able to think beyond the known, beyond the proven, and explore the unknown. That basically comes from chachma. That's where God makes himself available to the human soul. Now, if we inherit that kind of awareness, if God is real to us, more real than anything we can put together in our mind, than anything we can construct logically in our mind, then the result is that we are capable of giving up our lives, literally martyrdom, rather than deny or disconnect from that which our chachma sees. So all devotion that transcends logic is more real than the logic itself. Of course, there are things that are sub-logical. There are things that don't make sense because they're not true and they're not correct and they're not valid. Here we're talking about the super-rational. Something that is so real, so true, that no amount of knowledge could ever validate it, can ever encompass it, can ever make it more real, because it's absolutely true as it is. That's what we call faith. Now, what does this have to do with love? Here we get into chapter 19. In chapter 19, the Rebbe says as follows. The soul is often, in Torah, described as a candle. The soul of man is like a godly candle. What is the comparison? What's the similarity? The flame of a candle flickers upwards. Now, most things in nature are drawn downwards. The gravitational pull is always down to the earth. Actually, since all things are of the earth, they're all drawn back to Mother Earth. Everything is drawn to its source. So there's a philosophical side to gravity, and that is that everything wants to go back to its origins. The flame of the candle goes in the opposite direction. The flame flickers upwards. It wants to separate from the wick. It wants to tear itself away from the object that is burning. And by tearing itself away, it would extinguish itself. It would no longer be a visible flame. It would turn into some kind of energy which the origin of which is someplace in the heavens, not on earth. And so the candle, the flame of the candle, wants, so to speak, it wants, it is its nature, to tear itself away from the wick and to reunite, to be reabsorbed in the origins of energy, in the origins of fire, wherever that may be. And in doing so, the flame will not only lose its physical existence, it won't be a visible flame anymore, but when it gets absorbed into the source of energy, it will be totally unidentifiable. It will lose its identity there. When a stone falls back to earth after being tossed, it's going back to its origins, it's going back to its source, and when it returns to its source, it is at rest. It is a peaceful stone, very definitely a stone, but a stone feeling comfortable with its origins. It's sitting in the lap of its mother, so to speak. But when the flame returns to its origins, it extinguishes itself and loses its identity completely. We might say that this is an exception to the universal law of preservation and survival, where everything wants to preserve itself. The candle flame seems to be giving up its existence, extinguishing itself, just so that it can be back to where it started from. That's the similarity with the soul. The soul, by its very nature, which means without reason, wants to leave the body and go back to God. The soul is not of earth, and therefore doesn't feel comfortable on earth. It's not from the body. It doesn't feel comfortable with the body. It wants to go back to where it came from, to being a piece of God, but not a separated piece. Now, if the soul would tear itself away from the body, like the flame separating from the wick, it would, of course, stop existing as a human being on earth. But more than that, it would disappear into God and not even be an identifiable soul. So it's not that a soul is a better soul when it goes back to where it came from. It won't be a more comfortable soul, like the stone is comfortable sitting on earth. It will lose itself completely. This is real self-sacrifice. And yet, it is the very nature of the soul to want to extinguish itself and disappear, be reabsorbed back into the source of life, which is God Himself. Now, when we say it is the nature of the soul, or we say it's the nature of the flame, we're not really explaining anything at all. In fact, when we use the word nature concerning anything, when we say it does this by nature, it is its nature to do this, what we're really saying is we don't know why. There's no explanation. It is that way without any explanation. So how do we describe, how do we refer to something that is without reason? We call it nature. So the word nature is really a term that we use to describe the unexplainable. That which is the way it is, without needing a reason, that's called nature. So it's really not correct to say the nature of the soul, because the soul is beyond human nature. So what we mean is that the soul wants to extinguish itself and wants to be reabsorbed into God for no reason. It is not the result, this desire is not the result of some purpose or reason or intention or goal or objective. It's just the way a soul is. It is super rational. It is its true desire, not a desire that was created or produced by a reason. So when we say that we have a natural love for God, we're not talking about a conventional love. We're talking about the desire to merge with God, which has no reason, has no purpose. It doesn't benefit the soul in any way. And yet, there's nothing the soul wants more than to be reunited with God. This longing, this desire to expire, to extinguish itself and be merged with God, this is what we're describing as the natural love that the soul has for God. Conventional love does have an objective. When we love something or someone, we want to get closer to it. We want to have more of it. Here we're describing a longing that has no objective. The soul won't have more of God. It won't be a soul anymore. It won't get closer. It'll disappear completely. So this goes against, again, the principle of the survival instinct. Here there's no desire for survival. There's no desire here for improved survival. So it's not a conventional kind of a love. We call it love because love wants to get closer, and this wants to get closer, but for very different impulse, very different motivation. Now, in this desire to get closer to God, the soul is sometimes blocked, is sometimes frustrated, because the body and the animal soul, the human soul, that houses the soul, will sometimes interfere and drag the soul down, not permitting it to reunite with God or to even feel or express that desire to reunite with God. That's what we mean when we say God is in exile. Golus Hashchina. How can God be in exile? When the little piece of God, which is the soul, is trapped in the body and is not allowed to express itself and its desires, that's called exile. That's called captivity. And because the soul is a little piece of God, it's as if God himself were in exile. The little piece of God is in exile. And that's why this desire, this longing that the soul has to be reunited with God, this is described as a hidden love. It's not hidden only because it's concealed. It is essentially a hidden love. It's not an emotion like the love we're familiar with. It is essentially a hidden love. It's a desire to be with God that is not what we ordinarily think of as love. And that's why when it's blocked, it's not like a person can sit in prison and be separated from his family, but he loves his family intensely. Nothing can block his love. The prison can only keep him from being with the people he loves. But it doesn't block the love. It doesn't even hide the love. Here we're saying that when the soul is trapped in the body, it hides its love. How does it conceal its love? Because we're talking here not about an emotion, we're talking here about a longing to be united. And when it can't unite, then it is frustrated. What it wants is blocked. So you can love from a distance. And then the love is not hidden or blocked, it's only frustrated. But the desire to be merged with God can be denied and blocked. Because if you don't let the soul merge with God, then you have prevented it from having what it desires, not only from expressing it. So when a person's soul is trapped in the unholiness of life and of the body, that's like God being in exile. However, the effect that the body can have on the soul is only on the lower parts of the soul, the lower functions of the soul. The body can confuse the soul's understanding and confound its understanding of godliness by presenting contradictions, logical impossibilities, and so on. The animal soul, the body, can confound the soul's love of God, fear of God, compassion, can be misguided, corrupted, and so on. But the chachma of the soul cannot be affected by unholiness. So when the chachma of the soul is frustrated, it's frustrated only because the rest of the soul is not moving in the direction that the chachma moves in. So the chachma can be asleep in a person, but it can't be destroyed or compromised. And that's why the lowest of the low, the coarse and sinful person, is not affected by the chachma of his own soul, because it's like asleep and exiled within him. But should something challenge his very identity, should something threaten this chachma of his soul, it suddenly awakens, it suddenly comes alive, and has such a powerful effect on the rest of the soul, and not only the soul, but such a powerful effect on the garments of the soul, that suddenly all behavior changes. Suddenly he's willing to give up his life. He cannot worship an idol. He can't even go through the gestures of worship without truly worshiping. He can't even speak in a fashion that expresses a denial of his connection to God and of his Jewishness. When the chachma of the soul is stimulated, it produces such an intense reaction that the person will refuse even a meaningless gesture if it in any way suggests separating himself from God. We have, for example, the famous story of Hannah and her seven sons, which is associated with Hanukkah, where her sons were being forced to bow to an idol. And one after the other, they refused and were put to death. When it came to the youngest son, the story goes that the king, who was trying to enforce this idolatry on them, said to the youngest son, "I'm not even going to ask you to bow to the idol. I'm going to put my ring on the ground, on the floor, in front of the idol. And what I want you to do is pick up the ring." And the boy refused, because from a distance it would look like he's bowing to the idol. Now this kind of denial or resistance to even an empty act, an empty gesture that has nothing to do with idolatry, with worshiping idols, with believing in idols. There's no belief here, and there's no worship here. There's merely bending over to pick up a ring in front of an idol. And yet he can't do it. That has to be described as fear. He is so afraid of anything that threatens his identity and his connection to God, that he will refuse even the empty gesture because it smacks of denial of God. So we see that the Chochmah is more real than any emotion we could possibly produce. The awareness of God comes from God and not from ourselves. That produces a desire to merge with God and to never be separated from God in any way at all. This desire to merge with God is what we call hidden love. It's not the kind of love we're familiar with. It's a different kind of love. It's a desire to merge completely. And the refusal to bow to an idol or to say something that suggests that we are severing ourselves from God is so unthinkable, and we refuse it even at the cost of our lives, that that refusal or that resistance is called fear of God, even though it's not the fear that we usually associate with God fearing. As a result, when a person does a mitzvah, not by emotion that he produced through understanding, not even by a conviction produced through understanding, but simply by the very fact, the nature, the fact that a godly soul wants godliness, or in simple words, we do the mitzvah because a Jew is a Jew. That is a deeper, truer, more absolute love than the love of the scholar and the sage, than the conviction of the student who understands God to some degree. And this indestructible love can be described as emes la'amite, absolutely true. And therefore, when Moshe said, it is very close to you in your mouth and even in your heart to serve God, he was talking about the average person who has no understanding of God whatsoever and yet is so attached to God that in spite of everything, in spite of logic and reason, he wants to merge with God, wants to be part of God, even though it makes no sense at whatsoever.